Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 10:19 p.m. and that is British Summer Time. And today is Friday, October 4th, and it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. We just had the second day of the chart seminar today. It was, I think, a very animated conversation. There's a lot of points to cover. Something that I often try to do is point out what people, not so much what people have been asking for. At the chart seminar, we don't really have any examples, just on the basis that whatever it is that people are interested in, we should be able to analyze that, and but while also paying due heed to the fact that the easiest charts to analyze are those with the most consistent trends. And the biggest trends are those that have got the biggest imbalance between supply and demand. A few years ago, I started to deploy the exercise of reflecting back to people an awareness of it, of what it is they're interested in. Generally speaking, people ask to see the kinds of charts for the things they own or they're interested in buying that is often a reflection of what the consensus view is of where value might reside. And it's often a good exercise to think then about what it is that people did not ask for and whether those are potentially also areas which people might consider. Well, the big takeaway from the seminar today was that there was nobody asked to see the Nasdaq, but the Nasdaq posted a small upside key reversal yesterday and followed through on the upside in here today. I think that's something that we should really be paying attention to. When we just look at the daily chart, we have bounced pretty emphatically from the region of the trend mean on at least four occasions now since March. And when we look at this on a weekly basis, then what we're presented with is a market that did lose some consistency in 2018, pushed on to new high grounds, then had a much deeper pullback, and it was the biggest pullback we'd seen since at least 2009, but then rebounded and put in a large upside weekly key reversal from the region of the trend mean in May, and has since then been consolidating more or less in the region of the previous peak. And it's been a pretty tight consolidation, considering that the all-time peak is a hair over 8,000, and the moving average right now is at 6,000. Hold on, I was just reading the legend. The moving average is at 7,445. So what we're essentially talking about is a range with an amplitude of about 500 points on an 8,000 point index. And it looks like a bullish consolidation. It looks like we're going to see the market move higher. Of course, everybody's worried about a recession. Posting an interesting article today from Yardini Research following their tour out to California, and people are extraordinarily bearish. It's really quite amazing to see how bearish people are. The fact is, Ray Dalio has been writing reports saying that we're going to have a rerun of the 1930s. That has been swallowed hook, line, and sinker by just about everyone. They conclude that he is the maestro, that he knows everything there is to know, and that he couldn't possibly be wrong, and he might be yet right. There is still a very clear chance that we are going to have modern monetary theory at some stage. There is the other way of thinking about things, and it is that central banks are aware of what the risks are, and the risks are large, that we are going to see a clear socialist agenda taken on by some of the major economies of the world, where there is going to be a clear war on property rights. And that is a cause for concern for a considerable number of people. So they have seen their well, people that have been particularly lucky in life and have done particularly well are looking at the prospect of higher taxes, potentially wealth taxes, potentially inheritance taxes becoming radically higher. Certainly, there is that is one of the points. Of course, there's a substantial number of millennials that expect to inherit a great deal of money, and particularly hard assets from their parents. That is something that could become a problem if there are wealth taxes. It is increasingly likely that we are going to have some form of modern monetary theory deployed for the simple reason that we're halfway there already. When we think about what the Federal Reserve has been doing, the Trump administration started running large deficits in order to counterbalance the bump to the global economy that represented. The Fed started raising interest rates, and they kept going for as long as they could until the economy started showing signs of slowing down, and now they're cutting interest rates. At the same time, politicians on both sides of the aisle in Washington have agreed to increase deficits by over $1 trillion between now and the end of 2020. And there is a great deal of debt that needs to be sold, and Treasury yields are very proximate to their lows because investors are looking around the world. And this is a commonality move. But what I want to just drag this back to is the fact that central banks are willing to do whatever is necessary to avoid a recession. And they are going to cut interest rates. They're going to engage in quantitative easing. And they're very likely, in the process, to stoke a bubble in asset prices. That's one of the reasons why the stock market is rallying. Then, of course, we have the relative value argument. With government bond yields at such record low levels, then the return that is possible in stock markets is flattered by that relative value argument. So there is the potential here that we do see markets popping on the upside. That is a real possibility. Well, then let's think about what's going to happen in terms of US Treasuries, because one thing, well, I guess the other point, and it is a relevant point, is about the yield curve spread. The one thing we know about the yield curve is that it is a reliable lead indicator for future recessions. And this yield curve has been contracting since 2009. It went very briefly inverted back in August. Well, I guess it was probably more like September. The last time it went inverted was at the end of 2005, and we had a lot of fears about what that meant, and then people swiftly forgot about them because the recession did not happen imminently. Because when you do get an inverted yield curve, it isn't really until the yield curve starts to spike higher that we start to see meaningful deterioration in asset prices. That's when people really do start to take action about the prospect of an imminent recession. What people tend to forget is that the yield curve is a reliable lead indicator for future recessions, but it is a very long lead indicator. The lead can be anything from 6 to 18 months in duration. Now let's think about what happened after the inversion. The market in 2006, between the inversion and the peak in 2007, went up about 30%. The market first went inverted in 1998. It became even more inverted in 2000. But then it started to pop higher towards the end of 2000. In between the peak, or between the first inversion in 98 and the peak in 1999, what we saw was the market rising 50%. Well, let's just say, for example, the Nasdaq goes up another 30% from here. Well, we're talking about 10,000 on the Nasdaq, and that's a conservative estimate. If the S&P 500, the math is a lot easier, goes up a third from 3,000, we're talking about 4,000. That kind of bubbly activity is going to take valuations that are reasonable or somewhat overvalued at present and then turn them into rather silly valuations. That is one of the things that happens in a bubble. And these kinds of valuations occur because of many different factors, but one of the things that's clear is you get bubble valuations after periods when central banks make mistakes. And it is potentially true that central bankers are making mistakes. They're clearly trying to do anything to avoid a recession because they are essentially facing a catch-22 situation. If they don't stimulate and devalue their currencies, then they're going to have a recession. And if they do, well, they're betting that growth will pick up, or productivity will pick up, or that they are just forestalling the potential that the problem is going to be worse later, and that or that things will work out better simply because growth picks up and tries to ameliorate some of the debt problems. Of course, it rarely works like that. When we look at the yield curve, well, it has certainly inverted, and it looks, I think, quite similar to 1998. I think that there is the potential here, considering the valuations that we have and the potential for really quite incredible productivity gains, that we have to at least pay some consideration to the fact that the technology cycle is accelerating. The pace of technological innovation is quicker today than it has been ever. That not only did we have Moore's Law, and when we think about the company that has probably iterated fastest in terms of Moore's Law, well, Taiwan Semiconductor is pushing up and out of an 18-month range. There is a clear rounding characteristic to this range that has persisted for all that time, and this is a clear breakout. The company dominates the production of 7-nanometer chips. They've got a 90% market share. They're on the cusp of starting production of 5-nanometer chips, and they are ready to start producing 3-nanometer chips after that. So, that's probably about as good as Moore's Law is going to get. And those are the chips that are going to fuel the revolution in 5G. And companies that are going to benefit from that do appear to be starting to do better. So, for example, Samsung Electronics is also doing better at the present. And it has rallied over the course of the last couple of weeks to break its more than 18-month sequence of lower rally highs. And of course, this is a company that has got a dominant position in the production of a substantial number of consumer electronics. I will mention that one share that investors did not ask to see in the last 2 days was Apple. And yet, Apple is pushing up and out of its short-term range, and it is within very close striking distance of taking out its all-time peak and completing what has been a really very volatile range over the course of the last 12 months. This does not look like bearish activity. Now, when we think about the outlook for Microsoft, again, another one of the largest companies in the world. It has been ranging over the course of the last few months, and that has allowed the overbought condition relative to the trend mean to at least be partially unwound. One thing that we've definitely seen with some of these companies that are doing better is either they have a clear technological edge in an emerging consumer electronics sector like 5G, One of the reasons why I think 5G is important is because it's an enabling technology. It is going to have a similar effect on the global economy as the evolution of 4G had. If you think, for example, that it was the evolution of 4G and the connectivity that that enabled, which has really been the primary avenue through which Facebook has been able to grow. Facebook has become the mobile app, or WhatsApp, or Instagram have all become everyday apps and part of people's lives because of the rollout of 4G. Well, we're going to see a 10x upgrade in the speed of internet connections as a result of 5G. What that effectively means is that instead of spending 3 hours downloading a long movie like Gone with the Wind, it's going to take about 90 seconds. When we think about the bandwidth that that is going to deliver, then it's going to be an enabling technology for Internet of Things, like the smart home. We're already seeing a number of applications involving the smart home. So, for example, you have the smart speakers, you have the smart doorbells, you have the connected thermostats. Well, Apple is moving into this sector, but Amazon in particular is ramping up the production of Alexa-enabled connected devices in anticipation of the increasing demand for these kinds of products when 5G becomes ubiquitous. Then we have the potential for 5G to be revolutionary in terms of the connected car and the transportation experience. There is the realistic possibility that we are going to have autonomous vehicles within the next 3 or 4 years. There is a race on to get up to a level of service in these kinds of operations that is going to do away with personal ownership of vehicles. Personally think that it is much more likely that we're going to see haulage vehicles become a real phenomenon. We also have to remember, for example, that Tesla has come out with a battery that can la designs for a battery at least that can last for 1,000,000 miles. Well, there is no passenger vehicle that people are willing to drive around. Is you would have to be driving 50,000 miles a year for 20 years to exhaust that battery. Very few people drive more than 10 or 20,000 miles in a year. That means you would only really have to buy one car, and it could last you almost your entire driving life. But of course, if you're thinking about a haulage vehicle, a truck that is on the road all the time, then that kind of battery life that is not going to have degradation even after 1,000,000 miles is something that could be very attractive. Of course, it also becomes incredibly interesting for autonomous vehicles, which could be on the road 24/7. So then we have to think about these sorts of productivity gains. And of course, all of this is happening against a background where the pace of innovation in machine learning is increasing rapidly. The graphic I posted in Comment of the Day last Friday was one of the ability of an algorithm to predict chaotic cycles, and that was, I personally, one of the most profound things I've seen in years. The ability to predict a chaotic cycle is something that could revolutionize a large number of industries and answer questions that we've never thought to ask. That kind of pace of technological innovation, where we can answer questions, for example, like weather patterns. How does plasma interact within a fusion reactor? What is it that creates rogue waves in the ocean? And how can that be anticipated? When we think about fires or human activity These are all the kinds of questions. The kind of data collection that we're getting as a result of constant connectivity is something that will be also readily submittable to these kinds of deep learning algorithms. And that is probably something that is going to have an effect on the whole conception of free will. That is something that has already started to affect companies like Facebook. Facebook has been the subject of a great deal of opprobrium as a result of its I guess network being used to influence elections. But the much bigger issue is that what it has in fact done is very clearly create, or I guess not so much create, but made people aware of the fact that in when it comes to news consumption and the creation of perspectives and opinions that that free will is a myth. And that is something that is probably weighing on the share, but if it wasn't Facebook, it was going to be somebody else. The march of technology is something that can be used to a certain extent to change the way that people think about different topics. And it is influencing just about everything. We are going to see more and more of these kinds of attempts to influence public opinion through the media, and it does represent a very challenging environment. But of course, it also will be used for good. It will be used for productivity growth. It will be used to iron out inefficiencies in the economy. These are the kinds of innovations in the technology sector that have the potential to create secular bull markets. But of course, that doesn't mean that we can't have a bear market in between. And when we look at the outlook for treasuries, well, we had a very large upward dynamic 3 weeks ago, and now the yield has come all the way back down to test the 150 area, or the 1.5% level. That was the biggest upward dynamic we've seen in years. It suggests there is at least near-term resistance around this level. But we're going to have to see confirmation of a higher reaction low, or at least a break in the sequence of lower rally highs to confirm that a peak of near-term significance has been reached. When we think about what the outlook is for the global economy, well, we know that interest rates are already coming down. We're at the peak of the interest rate cycle. There is no debating that fact. The Federal Reserve does look like it is going to have to cut rates again, and the quantity of debt that is outstanding. And the fact, or the I guess the simple way of thinking about it, is that following the credit crisis, the absorption of private sector debts onto sovereign balance sheets has created a massive debt problem. The answer to that problem should have been to default and recapitalize, but they didn't do it. In fact, I believe it was Iceland was the only country in the world that forced those kinds of bankruptcies and recapitalizations, and since then their economy has done better. The larger economies of the world did not do that. At least the US banks were recapitalized following the foreclosure crisis. Europe has gone nowhere near doing that. They have instead imposed a fiscal austerity regime on the citizenry of the debtor countries, despite the fact that it was the bad investments of the pension funds of the creditor countries that were the primary problem. Well, at least there was shared responsibility on that front. And what we are seeing now is that the deaths are starting to continue, are continuing to mount. The downward pressure that is being felt on a number of banks is certainly something that's worth considering. When we think about the Euro Stoxx Banks Index, it's not really reflective of the problems in the banking sector because so many of the banks have already been closed or nationalized, and yet it is still trending downwards. We had a meaningful pop on the upside for a few weeks, but now it is starting to come back down again. It is absolutely going to have to break its sequence of lower rally highs, but what I would point out is the commonality in terms of the performance of the banks and the pattern that we have on US treasuries. Well, treasuries have shared the commonality. They've certainly been lagging in terms of the commonality that we see, for example, in German bonds or in JGBs. So the fact that bund yields are at least starting to steady here around a negative 60 basis point level is supportive of the view that we've seen a meaningful peak in terms of bond prices. But people are worried that we are late in the cycle. The one phenomenon that has been quite clear is that defensive sectors have been doing well. And generally speaking, when highly defensive sectors doing well, it's because there's a weakness in the economy and people are looking for security. They're not willing to take on risk. It's also because the wider stock market has been going sideways for the last 18 months, and people are worried that the kind of volatility that we've seen over the course of the last 7 or 8 months and the increasing manner in which news is being reported and the sensationalism around the Trump impeachment and the continued tweeting, that's all deleterious to sentiment, and yet the stock market is very close to its peak. When we see a company like Procter and Gamble doing so phenomenally well, this isn't necessarily because the share has it's justified in rallying nearly 100% in the space of a year, but rather that it has very strong cash flows and it has a reliable dividend, and that it has been increasing that dividend for nearly 40 consecutive years. This rally in the dividend aristocrats is something that continues to have legs, and it is, I think, quite clear that investors are willing to support this asset class because of the reliability of the dividends. Well, the other way of thinking about this is that the defensive nature of the market is something that is being influenced by the bond markets because of negative yielding debt, particularly and mostly in Europe and Japan. It's of course worth considering that the primary buyers of bonds with negative yields are governments. And they are the ones that are eventually going to carry that risk. Well, the central banks of the world have the potential to forgive the debt. When you consider that the size of the debt is mostly owed to governments, that the size of central bank balance sheets are so profoundly large because of the debt they have bought from their own governments. Well, that is really one aim arm of the government borrowing from the other. They could potentially forgive that debt. That is also another potential outcome, something that is not being considered. We are all willing to countenance that there is going to be modern monetary theory, there's going to be wealth taxes. People assume that the future is socialist, but it need not necessarily be that way. It is simply that is what people are willing to countenance right now, and particularly those people that live in California, which is a state that increasingly has a very socialist proclivity. It does not speak for the entire country, and it most certainly does not speak for the entire world. When we look at what is going on in terms of the UK, what he, I mean, Boris Johnson's speech earlier on this week, where he clearly stated that if the Conservative Party would were on a reality TV show, they would all have been voted off already. And that is a comical admittance of the failure of the political establishment to deliver on the promises that they have made. But what it is also reflective of is that there are alternatives, that the future does not have to be socialist, that there is a value in work, that there is a value in people's endeavor, and that it is this debate between the merits of supporting equal opportunity as opposed to equal distribution of rewards is not settled. And that is one of the most important points that we have, because it gets to the foundation of property rights. It's all about good governance. And it is that good governance is something that every investor needs to pay attention to. When you have respect for minority shareholder interests, an independent judiciary, and a free press, then those are the kinds of conditions that help us to ascertain whether a country has good governance. That was one of the reasons why I have been so conscious of the fact that the free press part of that equation is becoming less free. And because newspapers and journalists are increasingly partisan, then what they have effectively created is a market in the truth. And that is something that does represent an inhibition in terms of the standards of good governance. Of course, when we look at a market like China, international investors are increasingly attracted to it because it is one of the only places that has got growth. And it has a burgeoning middle class, but it has none of the characteristics of good governance. So what we are instead seeing there is the creation of a social military complex, which is analogous to fascism. And that is a really quite profound medium-term challenge in terms of the governance of the entire world. If we're really thinking about where the challenges are, it does reside in the increasing militarism of China, where they're displaying a hypersonic glide vehicle just this week in their annual, well, what is likely now to be an annual parade. The downward pressure that we're seeing on the Hang Seng is worthy of consideration, and the market was down again in here today. When we look at the weekly chart, there's been a clear downward bias since early this year. But yet, the price is still substantially above where it was back in 2016 or even back in 2011. It suggests that there is still a market in here and that the valuation is not demanding. But of course, what we would need to see in order to encourage investors back into the market is a moderation in terms of the protests that are going on there. The imposition of martial law is a real possibility. Now, that is something that is going to have a deleterious effect on the outlook for the growth potential of the region. And it's position as a major financial sector. People working in the financial sector are not going to take kindly to being told that they have to abide by a curfew. And the banning of masks is going to be a challenge from the perspective of a substantial portion of the polity. What it is going to encourage is nonconformism with a lot of the social norms, and that is probably going to represent a further escalation of trouble in the region. One of the points that I think is interesting is that the sectors that are influenced by Chinese demand have been quite weak, and the continuous commodity index is right now in the region of its trend mean. It hasn't quite been able to push up and through it yet. It may yet do so. That would help to bolster the inflation argument. I do think that the market in inflation is rather cheap right now because nobody believes that they are going to, or that we're going to see an inflationary outcome. Then, when we think about the outlook for some of the luxury brands, they have been really severely impacted by the fallout in demand from the protests in Hong Kong and falling Chinese demand. Kering, for example, is now encountering resistance in the region of the trend mean. It has experienced a great deal of trend deterioration, particularly following the acceleration in 2017 and 2018. This fallback in demand from from Chinese consumers for luxury goods is one important factor. The downward pressure that we're seeing in Australia, which had benefited from Chinese demand, is also worth considering. The Australian dollar is right in the region of its lows. It was in positive territory in here today. There is a somewhat overbought or oversold condition relative to the trend mean, but it has not been able to push back above the trend mean. It's going to have to we're going to have to see a move above 70 cents in order to do that. When we think about the resources sector, it's been a bit hit and miss, and it is now back below the trend mean, and that is against a background of a weak currency. When we think about the UK FTSE 350 mining index, then the more stable environment for the pound represents a challenge for that market, and it has not been able to, as of yet at least, sustain a move above the 20,000 level, and it's also looking a little ropey in here. China represents the epicenter of global risk. There is an issue in the shadow banking sector of India. They've cut the corporate tax rate. They're trying to consolidate the state-owned banks. The threat is from the shadow banking sector. That in particular has been a deleterious effect on Yes Bank, but there is increasing likelihood that there's going to be some support coming through for the bank in terms of it raising equity capital. The question, of course, is what is the price of that equity capital going to be? One of the models for raising equity capital had been Metro Bank in the UK, but that has not arrested the decline, and this potentially is a terminal decline, considering the pace of the downtrend. They're probably going to require additional assistance. This downward pressure that we're seeing in the banking sector, against a background where bond prices have been rising steadily. But the problem, of course, is that that helps their tier one capital, but it does nothing for their businesses. And it is robbing them of fee income and the spread on interest. Banks don't do well in an inverted yield curve environment. And this underperformance of banks is a significant issue. The underperformance, I think one of the things that people tend to forget about, and I think this is a point perhaps I didn't make forcefully enough at the chart seminar, is that banks are liquidity providers. And as liquidity providers, they should at least be doing as well as the market. But they're not doing as well as the market. If we look at, for example, the Euro Stoxx index, and we remember what the banking sector in Europe looks like, the banking sector is right on its decade lows, and the Euro Stoxx is within striking distance of the peaks for the last decade. Those are rather irreconcilable. The fact that banks are underperforming so profoundly means that they are incapable of providing liquidity. Now, that's important in Europe because it's already in recession. Germany is on the cusp of a recession, and it's likely to take much of Europe with it. And of course, Germany is dependent on China for demand. The fact that China's economy is slowing down, well, then that is weighing heavily on Europe. Then in China, the banks are underperforming, particularly the regional banks, but we can't monitor that. So we have to look at at basically derivatives of the Chinese market. It's in the USA where the banks have at least bounced from the region of the trend mean. They are still performing at more or less in line with the wider market. Therefore, when we think about where is the epicenter of risk, well, the epicenter of risk is China, and the epicenter of risk is Europe. And it is the USA continues to represent an area of relative strength. I think that's one of the more important points. When we think about the underperformance of banks, the fact that we have an inverted yield curve, that virtually ensures there is going to be a recession. And that recession will probably be at some point in the next 18 months. It's going to be largely contingent on unemployment rising in the USA. It is the US consumer is helping to support the US expansion. Therefore, when the US consumer starts to roll over, then it is likely to contribute to a global recession. But we're not there yet, and there is the potential that we have a bubble before we get there. The very nice thing about a bubble is that you can make money faster and far than anyone is used to doing. It also provides a wonderful opportunity to sell at a very high valuation and raise cash ahead of the next big buying opportunity, because there will be a big buying opportunity because of the pace of technological innovation. The one thing that we get following a recession is contagion selling. It means that there will be bargains. There will be a time when we will start looking again for clear relative strength, for early bottoming, for the kinds of instruments that are demonstrating relative strength. Well, we're seeing that already in the 5G sector. That does appear to be where we're getting additional upside. It could potentially be one of the leaders in terms of the continued move that we're seeing in the potential for a bubble to evolve. So I think that is one of the most important things to remember. What we can also think about is that gold has completed its base formation, and it is still consolidating. But the most important thing is that it has broken up and out of what was a 7-year range, and that demand for gold is increasing because of the risk of debasing of currencies. Because one way or the other, the quantity of debt that is outstanding, whether we eventually get a deflationary or an inflationary environment, the potential is that we're going to have negative real interest rates. And negative real interest rates is what helps to stoke demand for precious metals. And gold is appreciating in every currency. And it is when gold is appreciating in every currency that it tends to do best. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I wish all the best to all of you.